too few. Two-thirds of my strength was on the north side when the Lannisters attacked those still waiting to cross. Norrie, Locke, and Burlyman, chiefly, with Sir Willis Manderley and his White Harbour knights as rear guard. I was on the wrong side of the Trident, powerless to help them. Sir Willis rallied our men as best he could, but Gregor Clegane attacked with heavy horse and drove them into the river. As many drowned as were cut down, more fled, and the rest were taken captive. Gregor Clegane was always ill news, Catelyn reflected. Would Rob need to march south again to deal with him, or was the mountain coming here? Is Clegane across the river, then? No. Bolton's voice was soft but certain. I left 600 men at the ford, spearmen from the rills, the mountains, and the White Knife, 100 Hornwood longbows, some free riders and hedge knights, and a strong force of Stout and Serwin men to stiffen them. Ronald Stout and Sir Kyle Condon have the command. Sir Kyle was the late Lord Serwin's right hand, as I'm sure you know, my lady. Lions swim no better than wolves. So long as the river runs high, Sir Gregor will not cross. The last thing we need is the mountain at our backs when we start up the causeway, said Rob. You did well, my lord. Your grace is too kind. I suffered grievous losses on the Green Fork, and Glover and Talbot worse at Duskendale. Duskendale! Rob made the word a curse. Robert Glover will answer for that when I see him, I promise you. A folly, Lord Bolton agreed, but Glover was heedless after he'd learned that Deepwood Mott had fallen. Grief and fear will do that to a man. Duskendale was done and cold. It was the battle still to come that worried Catelyn. How many men have you brought, my son? She asked Roose Bolton pointedly. His queer, colourless eyes studied her face a moment before he answered. Some 500 horse and 3,000 foot, my lady, Dreadfort men in chief, and some from Carholt. With the loyalty of the Carstark so doubtful now, I thought it best to keep them close. I regret there are not more. It should be enough, said Rob. You will have command of my rear guard, Lord Bolton. I mean to start for the neck as soon as my uncle has been wedded and bedded. We're going home. Eddard. The grey light of dawn was streaming through his window when the thunder of hoofbeats awoke Eddard Stark from his brief, exhausted sleep. He lifted his head from the table to look down into the yard. Below, men in mail and leather and crimson cloaks were making the morning ring to the sound of swords and riding down mock warriors stuffed with straw. Ned watched Sandor Clegane gallop across the hard-packed ground to drive an iron-tipped lance through a dummy's head. Canvas ripped and straw exploded as Lannister guardsmen joked and cursed. Is this brave show for my benefit, he wondered. If so, Cersei was a greater fool than he'd imagined. Damn her, he thought. Why is the woman not fled? I've given her chance after chance. The morning was overcast and grim. Ned broke his fast with his daughters and Septa Mordane. Sansa, still disconsolate, stared sullenly at her food and refused to eat. But Arya wolfed down everything that was set in front of her. Sirio says we have time for one last lesson before we take ship this evening, she said. Can I, father? All my things are packed. A short lesson, and make certain you leave yourself time to bathe and change. I want you ready to leave by midday. Is that understood? By midday, Arya said. Sansa looked up from her food. If she can have a dancing lesson, why won't you let me say farewell to Prince Joffrey?
I would gladly go with her, Lord Eddard, Septa Mordane offered. There would be no question of her missing the ship.
It would not be wise for you to go to Joffrey right now, Sansa. I'm sorry. Sansa's eyes filled with tears. But why?
Sansa, your Lord Father knows best, Septa Mordane said. You are not to question his decisions.
It's not fair, Sansa pushed back from her table, knocked over her chair, and ran weeping from the solar. Septa Mordane rose, but Ned gestured her back to her seat. Let her go, Septa. I will try to make her understand when we're all safely back in Winterfell.
The Septa bowed her head and sat down to finish her breakfast. It was an hour later when Grand Maester Pycelle came to Eddard Stark in his cella. His shoulder slumped as if the weight of the great maester's chain around his neck had become too great to bear. "My lord," he said, "King Robert is gone. The guards give him rest."
"No," Ned answered. "He hated rest. The guards give him love and laughter and the joy of righteous battle."
It was strange how empty he felt. He had been expecting the visit. And yet with those words, something died within him. He would have given all his titles for the freedom to weep. But he was Robert's hand, and the hour he dreaded had come. "Be so good as to summon the members of the council here to my solar," he told Pycelle. The Tower of the Hand was as secure as he and Tomard could make it. He could not say the same for the council chamber.
"My lord," Pycelle blinked, "surely the affairs of the kingdom will keep till the morrow, when our grief is not so fresh."
Ned was quiet but firm.
"I fear we must convene at once." Pycelle bowed.
"As the hand commands."
He called his servants and sent them running, then gratefully accepted Ned's offer of a chair and a cup of sweet beer. Sir Barristan Selmy was the first to answer the summons, immaculate in white cloak and enamel scales.
"My lords," he said, "my place is beside the young king now. Pray give me leave to attend him."
"Your place is here, Sir Barristan," Ned told him. Littlefinger came next. Still garbed in the blue velvets and silver mockingbird cape he had worn the night previous, his boots dusty from riding.
"My lords," he said, smiling at nothing in particular before he turned to Ned, "that little task you set me is accomplished, Lord Eddard."
Varys entered, in a wash of lavender, pink from his bath, his plump face scrubbed and freshly powdered, his soft slippers all but soundless.
"The little birds sing a grievous song today," he said as he seated himself. "The realm weeps. Shall we begin?"
"When Lord Renly arrives," Ned said. Varys gave him a sorrowful look.
"I fear Lord Renly has left the city."
"Left the city?" Ned had counted on Renly's support.
"He took his leave through a postern gate an hour before dawn, accompanied by Sir Loras Tyrell and some 50 retainers," Varys told them. "When last seen, they were galloping south in some haste, no doubt bound for Storm's End or High Garden."
So much for Renly and his 100 swords. Ned did not like the smell of that, but there was nothing to be done for it. He drew out Robert's last letter. "The king called me to his side last night and commanded me to record his final words. Lord Renly and Grand Maester Pycelle stood witness as Robert sealed the letter, to be opened by the council after his death. Sir Barristan, if you would be so kind." The Lord Commander of the King's Guard examined the paper. "King Robert's seal and unbroken." He opened the letter and read, "Lord Eddard Stark is herein named Protector of the Realm, to rule as regent until the heir comes of age." "And as it happens, he is of age," Ned reflected. But he did not give voice to the thought. He trusted neither Pycelle nor Varys, and Sir Barristan was honour-bound to protect and defend the boy he thought his new king. The old knight would not abandon Joffrey easily. The need for a deceit was a bitter taste in his mouth. But Ned knew he must tread softly here. He must keep his counsel and play the game until he was firmly established as regent. There would be time enough to deal with the succession when Arya and Sansa were safely back in Winterfell, and Lord Stannis had returned to King's Landing with all his power. "I would ask this council to confirm me as Lord Protector, as Robert wished," Ned said, watching their faces, wondering what thoughts hid behind Pycelle's half-closed eyes, Littlefinger's lazy half-smile, and the nervous flutter of Varys's fingers. The door opened. Fat Tom stepped into the solar. "Pardon, my lords, the King's steward insists." The royal steward entered and bowed.
Esteemed lords, the king demands the immediate presence of his small council in the throne room. Ned had expected Cersei to strike quickly. The summons came as no surprise. The king is dead, he said. But we shall go with you, nonetheless. Tom, assemble an escort if you would. Littlefinger gave Ned his arm to help him down the steps. Varys, Pycelle, and Sir Barristan followed close behind. A double column of men-at-arms in chainmail and steel helms was waiting outside the tower, 8 strong. Grey cloaks snapped in the wind as the guardsmen marched them across the yard. There was no Lannister crimson to be seen, but Ned was reassured by the number of gold cloaks visible on the ramparts and at the gates. Jaina Slint met them at the door to the throne room, armoured in ornate black and gold plate, with a high-crested helm under one arm. The commander bowed stiffly. His men pushed open the great oaken doors, 20 feet tall and banded with bronze. The royal steward led them in. "All hail, His Grace, Joffrey of the Houses Baratheon and Lannister, the first of his name, King of the Andals and the Rhoynar and the First Men, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms and Protector of the Realm," he sang out. It was a long walk to the far end of the hall, where Joffrey awaited atop the Iron Throne. Supported by Littlefinger, Ned Stark slowly limped and hopped toward the boy who called himself King. The others followed. The first time he had come this way, he'd been on horseback, sword in hand, and the Targaryen dragons had watched from the walls as he forced Jaime Lannister down from the throne. He wondered if Joffrey would step down quite so easily. 5 knights of the King's Guard, all but Sir Jaime and Sir Barristan, were arrayed in a crescent around the base of the throne. They were in full armour, enamel steel from helm to heel, long pale cloaks over their shoulders, shining white shields strapped to their left arms. Cersei Lannister and her 2 younger children stood behind Sir Boros and Sir Meryn. The queen wore a gown of sea-green silk, trimmed with Moorish lace, as pale as foam. On her finger was a golden ring with an emerald the size of a pigeon's egg, on her head a matching tiara. Above them, Prince Joffrey sat amongst the barbs and spikes in a cloth of gold doublet and a red satin cape. Sandor Clegane was stationed at the foot of the throne's steep, narrow stair. He wore mail and soot-grey plate and his snarling dog's-head helm. Behind the throne, 20 Lannister guardsmen waited, with long swords hanging from their belts. Crimson cloaks draped their shoulders, and steel lions crested their helms. But Littlefinger had kept his promise. All along the walls, in front of Robert's tapestries, with their scenes of hunt and battle, the gold-cloaked ranks of the city watch stood stiffly to attention, each man's hand clasped around the haft of an 8-foot-long spear tipped in black iron. They outnumbered the Lannisters 5-1. Ned's leg was a blaze of pain by the time he stopped. He kept a hand on Littlefinger's shoulder to help support his weight. Joffrey stood. His red satin cape was patterned in gold thread, 50 roaring lions to one side, 50 prancing stags to the other.
"I command the council to make all the necessary arrangements for my coronation," the boy proclaimed. "I wish to be crowned within the fortnight. Today I shall accept oaths of fealty for my loyal councillors."
Ned produced Robert's letter. "Lord Varys, be so kind as to show this to my Lady of Lannister." The eunuch carried the letter to Cersei. The queen glanced at the words. "Protector of the realm," she read. "Is this meant to be your shield, my lord? A piece of paper?" She ripped the letter in half, ripped the halves into quarters, and let the pieces flutter to the floor.
"Those were the king's words," Sir Barristan said, shocked.
"We have a new king now," Cersei Lannister replied. "Lord Eddard, when last we spoke, you gave me some counsel. Allow me to return the courtesy."
"Bend the knee, my lord. Bend the knee and swear fealty to my son, and we shall allow you to step down his hand and live out your days in the grey waste you call home."
"Would that I could," Ned said grimly. If she were so determined to force the issue here and now, she left him no choice. "Your son has no claim to the throne he sits. Lord Stannis is Robert's true heir."
"Liar!"
Joffrey screamed, his face reddening.
"Mother, what does he mean?" Princess Marcella asked the Queen plaintively. "Isn't Joff the king now?"
"You condemn yourself with your own mouth, Lord Stark," said Cersei Lannister. "Sir Barristan, seize this traitor." The Lord Commander of the King's Guard hesitated. In the blink of an eye, he was surrounded by Stark guardsmen, bare steel in their mailed fists. "And now the treason moves from words to deeds," Cersei said. "Do you think Sir Barristan stands alone, my lord?" With an ominous rasp of metal on metal, the hound drew his longsword. The knights of the King's Guard and 20 Lannister guardsmen in crimson cloaks moved to support him.
"Kill him!" the boy king screamed down from the Iron Throne. "Kill all of them! I command it!"
"You leave me no choice," Ned told Cersei Lannister. He called out to Jaina Slint. "Commander, take the Queen and her children into custody. Do them no harm, but escort them back to the royal apartments and keep them there under guard." "Men of the watch," Jaina Slint shouted, donning his helm. 100 gold cloaks leveled their spears and closed. "I want no bloodshed," Ned told the Queen. "Tell your men to lay down their swords, and no one need—" With a single sharp thrust, the nearest gold cloak drove his spear into Tomard's back. Fat Tom's blade dropped from nerveless fingers as the wet red point burst out through his ribs, piercing leather and mail. He was dead before his sword hit the floor. Ned's shot came far too late. Jaina Slint himself slashed open Varley's throat. Cain whirled, steel flashing, drove back the nearest spearman with a flurry of blows. For an instant it looked as though he might cut his way free. Then the hound was on him. Sandor Clegane's first cut took off Cain's sword hand at the wrist. His second drove him to his knees and opened him from shoulder to breastbone. As his men died around him, Littlefinger slid Ned's dagger from its sheath and shoved it up under his chin. His smile was apologetic. "I did warn you not to trust me, you know."
John. "Rillo!" sang Melisandre, her arms upraised against the falling snow. "You are the light in our eyes, the fire in our hearts, the heat in our loins. Yours is the sun that warms our days. Yours the stars that guard us in the dark of night. All praise R'hllor, the Lord of Light." The wedding guests answered in ragged chorus before a gust of ice-cold wind blew their words away. Jon Snow raised the hood of his cloak. The snowfall was light today, a thin scattering of flakes dancing in the air. But the wind was blowing from the east along the wall, cold as the breath of the ice dragon in the tales old Nan used to tell. Even Melisandre's fire was shivering. The flames huddled down in the ditch, crackling softly as the red priestess sang. Only ghosts seemed not to feel the chill. Addis Carstock leaned close to John.
"Snow during a wedding means a cold marriage. My lady mother always said so."
He glanced at Queen Selyse. There must have been a blizzard the day she and Stannis wed. Huddled beneath her ermine mantle and surrounded by her ladies, serving girls and knights, the Southron queen seemed a frail, pale, shrunken thing. A strained smile was frozen into place on her thin lips, but her eyes brimmed with reverence. She hates the cold, but loves the flames. He had only to look at her to see that. A word from Melisandre, and she would walk into the fire willingly, embrace it like a lover. Not all her queen's men seemed to share her fervour. Sir Brus appeared half-drunk. Sir Malagorn's gloved hand was cupped round the arse of the lady beside him. Sir Narbot was yawning, and Sir Patrick of King's Mountain looked angry. John Snow had begun to understand why Stannis had left them with his queen. "The night is dark and filled with terrors," Melisandre sang. "Alone we are born, and alone we die. But as we walk through this black veil, we draw strength from one another, and from you, our lord." Her scarlet silks and satins swirled with every gust of wind. "Two come forth today to join their lives, so they may face this world's darkness together. Fill their hearts with fire, my lord, so they may walk your shining path hand in hand forever."
"Lord of light, protect us," cried Queen Selyse.
Other voices echoed the response. Melisandre's faithful, pallid ladies, shivering serving girls, Sir Axel and Sir Narbot and Sir Lambert, men-at-arms in iron mail and thens in bronze, even a few of John's black brothers.
"Lord of light, bless your children."
Melisandre's back was to the wall on one side of the deep ditch where her fire burned. The couple to be joined faced her across the ditch. Behind them stood the queen, with her daughter and her tattooed fool. Princess Shireen was wrapped in so many furs that she looked round, breathing in white puffs through the scarf that covered most of her face. Sir Axel Florent and his queen's men surrounded the royal party, with the tall Bravassi banker looming over all of them. Though only a few men of the Night's Watch had gathered about the ditch fire, more looked down from rooftops and windows and the steps of the great switchback stair. John took careful note of who was there and who was not. Some men had the duty, many just off watch were fast asleep, but others had chosen to absent themselves to show their disapproval. Athel Yarwick and Bowen Marsh were amongst the missing. Septon Shale had emerged briefly from the sept, fingering the seven-sided crystal on the thong about his neck, only to retreat inside again once the prayers began. Melisandre raised her hands, and the ditch fire leapt upwards towards her fingers, like a great red dog springing for a treat. A swirl of sparks rose to meet the snowflakes coming down. "O Lord of Light, we thank you," she sang to the hungry flames. "We thank you for brave Stannis. By your grace, our king, guide him and defend him, R'hllor. Protect him from the treacheries of evil men, and grant him strength to smite the servants of the dark."
"Grant him strength," answered Queen Selyse and her knights and ladies. "Grant him courage. Grant him wisdom."
Alice Carstark slipped her arm through John's.
"How much longer, Lord Snow? If I'm to be buried beneath this snow, I'd like to die a woman wed."
"Soon, my lady," John assured her. "Soon."
"We thank you for the sun that warms us," chanted the queen. "We thank you for the stars that watch over us in the black of night. We thank you for our hearths and for our torches, which keep the savage dark at bay. We thank you for our bright spirits, the fires in our loins and in our hearts."
And Melisandre said, "Let them come forth who would be joined." The flames cast her shadow on the wall behind her, and her ruby gleamed against the paleness of her throat. John turned to Alice Carstark. "My lady, are you ready?"
"Yes, oh yes."
"You're not scared?" The girl smiled in a way that reminded John so much of his little sister that it almost broke his heart.
"Let him be scared of me."
The snowflakes were melting on her cheeks, but her hair was wrapped in a swirl of lace that Saturn had found somewhere, and the snow had begun to collect there, giving her a frosty crown. Her cheeks were flushed and red, and her eyes sparkled. "Winter's lady," John squeezed her hand. The Magnar of Thenn stood waiting by the fire, clad as if for battle, in fur and leather and bronze scales, a bronze sword at his hip. His receding hair made him look older than his years, but as he turned to watch his bride approach, John could see the boy in him. His eyes were big as walnuts, though whether it was the fire, the priestess, or the woman that had put the fear in him, John could not say. Alice was more right than she knew.
"Who brings this woman to be wed?" asked Melisandre.
"I do," said John. "Now comes Alice of House Carstark, a woman grown and flowered, of noble blood and birth." He gave her hand one last squeeze and stepped back to join the others.
"Who comes forth to claim this woman?" asked Melisandre.
"Me." Sigorn slapped his chest. "Magna of Thenn." "Sigorn," asked Melisandre, "will you share your fire with Alice and warm her when the night is dark and full of terrors?" "I swear me." The Magna's promise was a white cloud in the air. Snow dappled his shoulders. His ears were red. "By the red god's flames, I warm her all her days."
"Alice, do you swear to share your fire with Sigorn and warm him when the night is dark and full of terrors?" "Till his blood is boiling."
Her maiden's cloak was the black wool of the night's watch. The Carstark sunburst, sewn on its back, was made of the same white fur that lined it. Melisandre's eyes shone as bright as the ruby at her throat.
"Then come to me and be as one."
As she beckoned, a wall of flames roared upwards, licking at the snowflakes with hot orange tongues. Alice Carstark took her Magna by the hand. Side by side, they leapt the ditch.
"Two went into the flames."
A gust of wind lifted the red woman's scarlet skirts till she pressed them down again.
"One emerges."
Her coppery hair danced about her head.
"What fire joins, none may put asunder."
"What fire joins, none may put asunder," came the echo from Queen's men and Thenn's and even a few of the Black Brothers. "Except for kings and uncles," thought Jon Snow. Craig and Carstark had turned up a day behind his niece. With him came four mounted men-at-arms, a huntsman and a pack of dogs, sniffing after Lady Alice as if she were a deer. Jon Snow met them on the King's Road, half a league south of Molestown, before they could turn up at Castle Black, claim guest right, or call for parley. One of Carstark's men had loosed a crossbow quarrel at Tye and died for it. That left four, and Cregan himself. Fortunately, they had a dozen ice cells, room for all. Like so much else, heraldry ended at the wall. The Thenns had no family arms, as was customary amongst the nobles of the Seven Kingdoms, so John told the Stuarts to improvise. He thought they had done well. The bride's cloak, Sigorn fastened about Lady Alice's shoulders, showed a bronze disc on a field of white wool, surrounded by flames made with wisps of crimson silk. The echo of the Carstark sunburst was there for those who cared to look, but differenced to make the arms appropriate for House Thenn. The Magnor all but ripped the maiden's cloak from Alice's shoulders, but when he fastened her bride's cloak about her, he was almost tender. As he leaned down to kiss her cheek, their breath mingled. The flames roared once again. The Queen's men began to sing a song of praise.
"Is it done?" John heard Satin whisper.
"Done and done," muttered Molly, "and a good thing. They're wed, and I'm half rose."
He was muffled up in his best blacks, woolen so new
They had hardly had a chance to fade yet. But the wind had turned his cheeks as red as his hair.
Hobbs mulled some wine with cinnamon and cloves. That'll warm us some.
What cloves? Asked Owen the oaf. The snow had started to descend more heavily, and the fire in the ditch was guttering out. The crowd began to break apart and stream from the yard, queensmen, kingsmen, and free folk alike, all anxious to get out of the wind and the cold.
"Will my lord be feasting with us?"
Molly asked John Snow. "Shortly. Sigurn might take it as a slight if he did not appear. And this marriage is mine own work, after all. I have other matters to attend to first, however." John crossed to Queen Selyse, with Ghost beside him. His boots crunched through piles of old snow. It was growing ever more time-consuming to shovel out the paths from one building to another. More and more, the men were resorting to the underground passages they called wormways.
"Such a beautiful rite," the Queen was saying. "I could feel our Lord's fiery gaze upon us. Oh, you cannot know how many times I have begged Stannis to let us be wed again. A true joining of body and spirit, blessed by the Lord of Light. I know that I could give his grace more children if we were bound in fire."
"To give him more children, you would first need to get him into your bed." Even at the wall, it was common knowledge that Stannis Baratheon had shunned his wife for years. One could only imagine how his grace had responded to the notion of a second wedding in the midst of his war. John bowed. "If it please your grace, the feast awaits." The queen glanced at Ghost suspiciously, then raised her head to John.
"To be sure, Lady Melisandre knows the way."
The red priestess spoke up.
"I must attend my fires, your grace. Perhaps Rilor will vouchsafe me a glimpse of his grace."
"A glimpse of some great victory, mayhaps."
"Oh," Queen Selyse looked stricken. "To be sure, let us pray for a vision from our lord."
"Satin, show her grace to her place," said John. Sir Melgorn stepped forward.
"I will escort her grace to the feast. We shall not require your, steward."
The way the man drew out the last word told John that he had been considering saying something else. "Boy? Pet? Whore?" John bowed again. "As you wish. I shall join you shortly." Sir Melagon offered his arm, and Queen Selyse took it, stiffly. Her other hand settled on her daughter's shoulder. The royal ducklings fell in behind them as they made their way across the yard, marching to the music of the bells on the fool's hat.
"Under the sea the mermen feast on starfish soup, and all the serving men are crabs,"
Patchface proclaimed as they went.
I know, oh.
Melisandre's face darkened.
"That creature is dangerous. Many a time I have glimpsed him in my flames. Sometimes there are skulls about him, and his lips are red with blood."
"I wonder you haven't had the poor man burned." All it would take was a word in the queen's ear, and Patchface would feed her fires. "You see fools in your fire, but no hint of Stannis.
When I search for him, all I see is snow."
The same useless answer. Clydes had dispatched a raven to Deepwood Mott to warn the king of Arnulf Carstark's treachery, but whether the bird had reached his grace in time, John did not know. The Bravassé banker was off in search of Stannis as well, accompanied by the guides that John had given him. But between the war and weather, it would be a wonder if he found him. "Would you know if the king was dead?" John asked the Red Priestess.
"He is not dead. Stannis is the Lord's chosen, destined to lead the fight against the dark. I have seen it in the flames, read of it
in ancient prophecy. When the red star bleeds and the darkness gathers, Azor Ahai shall be born again amid smoke and salt to wake dragons out of stone. Dragonstone is the place of smoke and salt.
John had heard all this before. Stannis Baratheon was the lord of Dragonstone, but he was not born there. He was born at Storm's End, like his brothers. He frowned. And what of Mance? Is he lost as well? What do your fires show?
The same, I fear, only snow.
Snow. It was snowing heavily to the south, John knew. Only 2 days' ride from here. The King's Road was said to be impassable. Melisandre knows that too. And to the east, a savage storm was raging on the Bay of Seals. At last report, the ragtag fleet they had assembled to rescue the free folk from Hardhome still huddled at Eastwatch by the sea, confined to port by the rough seas. You're seeing cinders dancing in the updraft.
I am seeing skulls. And you? I see your face every time I look into the flames. The danger that I warned you of grows very close now.
Daggers in the dark, I know. You will forgive my doubts, my lady. A grey girl on a dying horse, fleeing from a marriage? That was what you said.
I was not wrong.
You were not right. Alice is not Arya.
The vision was a true one. It was my reading that was false. I am as mortal as you, Jon Snow, all mortals' heir.
Even Lord Commanders. Mance Rayder and his spare wives had not returned, and Jon could not help but wonder whether the Red Woman had lied of a purpose. Is she playing her own game?
You would do well to keep your wolf beside you, my lord.
Ghost is seldom far. The direwolf raised his head at the sound of his name. John scratched him behind the ears. But now you must excuse me. Ghost, with me. Carved from base of the wall, and closed with heavy wooden doors, the ice cells ranged from small to smaller. Some were big enough to allow a man to pace, others so small that prisoners were forced to sit. The smallest were too cramped to allow even that. John had given his chief captive the larger cell, a pail to shit in, enough furs to keep him from freezing, and a skin of wine. It took the guard some time to open his cell, as ice had formed inside the lock. Rusted hinges screamed like damned souls when Wick Whittlestick yanked the door wide enough for John to slip through. A faint, fecal odor greeted him, though less overpowering than he'd expected. Even shit froze solid in such bitter cold. Jon Snow could see his own reflection dimly inside the icy walls. In one corner of the cell, a heap of furs was piled up almost to the height of a man.
"Carstock," said Jon Snow, "wake up."
The furs stirred. Some had frozen together, and the frost that covered them glittered when they moved. An arm emerged, then a face, brown hair, tangled and matted and streaked with grey. Two fierce eyes, a nose, a mouth, a beard. Ice caked the prisoner's moustache. Clumps of frozen snot.
Snow!
His breath steamed in the air, fogging the ice behind his head.
You have no right to hold me, the laws of hospitality. You are no guest of mine. You came to the wall without my leave, armed, to carry off your niece against her will. Lady Alice was given bread and salt. She is a guest. You are a prisoner.
John let that hang for a moment, then said, your niece is wed. Cregan Carstark's lips skinned back from his teeth.
Alice was promised to me.
Though past 50, he had been a strong man when he went into the cell. The cold had robbed him of that strength and left him stiff and weak.
My lord father.
Your father is a castellan, not a lord.
and a castellan has no right to make marriage pacts. My father, Arnulf, is lord of Carhold. A son comes before an uncle, by all the laws I know. Cregan pushed himself to his feet and kicked aside the furs clinging to his ankles. Harrion is dead, or will be soon. A daughter comes before an uncle, too. If her brother is dead, Carhold belongs to Lady Ellis, and she has given her hand in marriage to Sigorn, Magna of Thenn. A wildling, a filthy, murdering wildling. Cregan's hands closed into fists. The gloves that covered them were leather, lined with fur to match the cloak that hung matted and stiff from his broad shoulders. His black wool surcoat was emblazoned with the white sunburst of his house. I see what you are, Snow. Half a wolf and half a wildling, base-born get of a traitor and a whore. You would deliver a high-born maid to the bed of some stinking savage. Did you sample her yourself first? He laughed. If you mean to kill me, do it, and be damned for a kinslayer. Stark and Carstock are one blood. My name is Snow. Bastard. Guilty of that, at least. Let this Magna come to Carhold. We'll hack off his head and stuff it in a privy, so we can piss into his mouth. Sigorn leads 200 thins, John pointed out, and Lady Alice believes Carhold will open its gates to her. Two of your men have already sworn her their service, and confirmed all she had to say concerning the plans your father made with Ramsay Snow. You have close kin at Carhold, I'm told. A word from you could save their lives. Yield the castle. Lady Alice will pardon the women who betrayed her and allow the men to take the black. Cregan shook his head. Chunks of ice formed about the tangles in his hair and clicked together softly when he moved. Never, he said, never, never, never. I should make his head a wedding gift for Lady Alice and her Magna, John thought, but dared not take the risk. The Night's Watch took no part in the quarrels of the realm. Some would say he had already given Stannis too much help. Behead this fool, and they will claim I'm killing Northmen to give their lands to wildlings. Release him, and he will do his best to rip apart all I've done with Lady Ellis and the Magna. John wondered what his father would do, how his uncle might deal with this. But Eddard Stark was dead. Benjen Stark lost in the frozen wilds beyond the wall. You know nothing, Jon Snow. Never is a long time, John said. You may feel differently on the morrow, or a year from now. Soon or late, King Stannis will return to the wall, however. When he does, he will have you put to death, unless it happens that you are wearing a black cloak. When a man takes the black, his crimes are wiped away. Even such a man as you. Now pray excuse me. I have a feast to attend. After the biting cold of the ice cells, the crowded cellar was so hot that John felt suffocated from the moment he came down the steps. The air smelled of smoke and roasting meat and mulled wine. Axel Florent was making a toast as John took his place upon the dais. To King Stannis and his wife, Queen Selyse, Light of the North, Sir Axel bellowed. To R'hllor, the Lord of Light, may he defend us all. One land, one God, one king. One land, one God, one king, the Queen's men echoed. John drank with the rest. Whether Alice Carstock would find any joy in her marriage, he could not say, but this one night, at least, should be one of celebration. The stewards began to bring out the first dish, an onion broth flavoured with bits of goat and carrot. Not precisely royal fare, but nourishing. It tasted well enough, and warmed the belly. Owen the Oaf took up his fiddle, and several of the free folk joined in with pipes and drums.
the same pipes and drums they played to sound Manse Raiders attack upon the wall. John thought they sounded sweeter now. With the broth came loaves of coarse brown bread, warm from the oven. Salt and butter sat upon the tables. The sight made John gloomy. They were well provided with salt, Bowen Marsh had told him, but the last of the butter would be gone within a moon's turn. Old Flint and the Norrie had been given places of high honour just below the dais. Both men had been too old to march with Stannis. They had sent their sons and grandsons in their stead. But they had been quick enough to descend on Castle Black for the wedding. Each had brought a wet nurse to the wall as well. The Norrie woman was 40, with the biggest breasts John had ever seen. The Flint girl was 14, and flat-chested as a boy, though she did not lack for milk. Between the two of them, the child, Val called Munster, seemed to be thriving. For that much John was grateful, but he did not believe for a moment that two such hoary old warriors would have hied down from their hills for that alone. Each had brought a tale of fighting men, 5 for old Flint, 12 for the Norrie, all clad in ragged skins and studded leathers, fearsome as the face of winter. Some had long beards, some had scars, some had both. All worshipped the old gods of the north, those same gods worshipped by the free folk beyond the wall. Yet here they sat, drinking to a marriage hallowed by some queer red god from beyond the seas. Better that than refuse to drink. Neither Flint nor Norrie had turned their cups over to spill their wine upon the floor. That might betoken a certain acceptance. Or perhaps they just hate to waste good southern wine. They will not have tasted much of it up in those stony hills of theirs. Between courses, Sir Axel Florent led Queen Selyse out onto the floor to dance. Others followed. The Queen's knights first, partnered with her ladies. Sir Brus gave Princess Shireen her first dance, then took a turn with her mother. Sir Narbet danced with each of Selyse's lady companions in turn. The Queen's men outnumbered the Queen's ladies 3-1, so even the humblest serving girls were pressed into the dance. After a few songs, a few black brothers remembered skills learned at the courts and castles of their youth, before their sins had sent them to the wall, and took the floor as well. That old rogue, Ulmer, of the Kingswood, proved as adept at dancing as he was at archery, no doubt regaling his partners with his tales of the Kingswood Brotherhood, when he rode with Simon Toyne and Big Belly Ben and helped Wenda the White Fawn burn her mark in the buttocks of her high-born captives. Saturn was all grace, dancing with 3 serving girls in turn, but never presuming to approach a high-born lady. John judged that wise. He did not like the way some of the Queen's knights were looking at the steward, particularly Sir Patrick of King's Mountain. "That one wants to shed a bit of blood," he thought. "He's looking for some provocation." When Owen the Oaf began to dance with Patchface, the fool, laughter echoed off the vaulted ceiling. The sight made Lady Alice smile.
"D'ye dance often here at Castle Black?"
"Every time we have a wedding, my lady."
"You could dance with me, you know. It would be only courteous. You dance with me anon."
"Anon?" teased John.
"When we were children." She tore off a bit of bread and threw it at him. "As you know well."
"My lady should dance with her husband."
"My Magna is not one for dancing, I fear. If you will not dance with me, at least pour me some of the mulled wine."
"As you command." He signalled for a flagon.
"So," said Alice, as John poured, "I am now a woman wed, a wilding husband with his own little wilding army."
"Free folk is what they call themselves. Most, at least. The Fens are a people apart, though. Very old."
Ygritte had told him that. "You know nothing, Jon Snow. They come from a hidden vale at the north end of the Frostfangs, surrounded by high peaks, and for thousands of years they've had more truck with the giants than with other men. It made them different." "Different," she said, "but more like us." "Aye, my lady, the Fens have lords and laws. They know how to kneel. They mine tin and copper for bronze, forge their own arms and armor instead of stealing it. A proud folk and brave. Mansraider had to best the old Magna thrice before Styr would accept him as king beyond the wall. And now they are here, on our side of the wall, driven from their mountain fastness and into my bedchamber." She smiled a wry smile. "It is my own fault. My lord father told me I must charm your brother Rob, but I was only 6 and didn't know how." "Aye, but now you're almost 6 and 10, and we must pray you will know how to charm your new husband. My lady, how do things stand at Carhold with your food stores?" "Not well," Alice sighed. "My father took so many of our men south with him that only the women and young boys were left to bring the harvest in. Them and the men too old or crippled to go off to war. Crops withered in the fields or were pounded into the mud by autumn rains. And now the snows are come. This winter will be hard. Few of the old people will survive it, and many children will perish as well." It was a tale that any Northman knew well. "My father's grandmother was a Flint of the mountains, on his mother's side," John told her. "The first Flints, they call themselves. They say the other Flints are the blood of younger sons who had to leave the mountains to find food and land and wives. It has always been a harsh life up there. When the snows fall and food grows scarce, their young must travel to the winter town or take service at one castle or the other. The old men gather up what strength remains in them and announce that they are going hunting. Some are found come spring. More are never seen again." "It is much the same at Carhold." That did not surprise him. "When your stores begin to dwindle, my lady, remember us. Send your old men to the wall. Let them say our words. Here, at least, they will not die alone in the snow, with only memories to warm them. Send us boys as well, if you have boys to spare."
"As you say,"
she touched his hand,
"Carhold remembers."
The elk was being carved. It smelled better than John had any reason to expect. He dispatched a portion to Leathers out at Harden's Tower, along with 3 big platters of roast vegetables for one, then ate a healthy slice himself. Three-finger Hubs acquitted himself well. That had been a concern. Hub had come to him 2 nights ago, complaining that he'd joined the night's watch to kill wildlings, not to cook for them. "Besides, I never done no wedding feast, my lord. Black brothers don't never take no wives. It's in the bloody vows. I swear it is." John was washing the roast down with a sip of mulled wine when Clydes appeared at his elbow.
"A bird,"
he announced, and slipped a parchment into John's hand. The note was sealed with a dot of hard black wax. Eastwatch, John knew, even before he broke the seal. The letter had been written by Maester Harmoon. Cotter Pike could neither read nor write, but the words were Pike's, set down as he had spoken them, blunt and to the point. "Calm seas today. 11 ships set sail for Hartholm on the morning tide. 3 Bravosses, 4 Lyseni, 4 of ours. 2 of the Lyseni barely seaworthy. We may drown more wildlings than we save. Your command, 20 ravens aboard, and Maester Harmoon. We'll send reports. I command from Talon, Tattersalt, 2nd on Blackbird. Sir Glendon holds East Watch." "Dark Wings, "Dark words?" asked Alice Carstark.
"No, my lady. This news was long awaited, though the last part troubles me. Glendon Hewitt was a seasoned man and a strong one, a sensible choice to command in Cutter Pike's absence. But he was also as much a friend as Alistair Thorne could boast, and a crony of sorts with Janus Slint, however briefly. John could still recall how Hewitt had dragged him from his bed, and the feel of his boot slamming into his ribs. Not the man I would have chosen. He rolled the parchment up and slipped it into his belt. The fish course was next, but as the pike was being boned, Lady Alice dragged the Magnar up onto the floor. From the way he moved, it was plain that Sigorn had never danced before, but he had drunk enough mulled wine so that it did not seem to matter.
A northern maid and a wilding warrior, bound together by the Lord of Light.
Sir Axel Florent slipped into Lady Alice's vacant seat.
Her Grace approves. I am close to her, my lord, so I know her mind. King Stannis will approve as well.
Unless Roose Bolton has struck his head on a spear.
Not all agree, alas.
Sir Axel's beard was a ragged brush beneath his sagging chin. Coarse hair sprouted from his ears and nostrils.
Sir Patrick feels he would have made a better match for Lady Alice. His lands were lost to him when he came north.
There are many in this hall who have lost far more than that, said John, and more who have given up their lives in service to the realm. Sir Patrick should count himself fortunate. Axel Florent smiled.
The king might say the same if he were here. Yet some provision must be made for his grace's leal knights, surely. They have followed him so far and at such cost, and we must needs bind these wildlings to king and realm. This marriage is a good first step, but I know that it would please the queen to see the wildling princess wed as well.
John sighed. He was weary of explaining that Val was no true princess. No matter how often he told them, they never seemed to hear.
You are persistent, Sir Axel. I grant you that. Do you blame me, my lord? Such a prize is not easily won. A nubile girl, I hear, and not hard to look upon. Good hips, good breasts, well made for whelping children.
Who would father these children? Sir Patrick? You?
Who better? We Florens have the blood of the old gardener kings in our veins. Nelly Melisandre could perform the rites, as she did for Lady Alice and the Magna.
All you are lacking is a bride.
Easily remedied.
Florence's smile was so forced that it looked painful.
Where is she, Lord Snow? Have you moved her to one of your other castles, Greyguard or the Shadow Tower? Horseborough with t'other wenches?
He leaned close.
Some say you have her tucked away for your own pleasure. Makes no matter to me, so long as she is not with child. I'll get my own sons on her. If you've broken her to saddle, well, we are both men of the world, are we not?
John had heard enough. Sir Axel, if you are truly the Queen's hand, I pity her grace. Florence's face grew flushed with anger.
So it is true. You mean to keep her for yourself. I see it now. The bastard wants his father's seat.
The bastard refused his father's seat. If the bastard had wanted Val, all he had to do was ask for her.
You must excuse me, sir, he said. I need a breath of fresh air.
It stinks in here. His head turned.
That was a horn.
Others had heard it too. The music and the laughter died at once. Dancers froze in place, listening. Even Ghost pricked up his ears.
Did you hear that?
Queen Selyse asked her knights.
A war horn, your grace, said Sir Narbot.
The queen's hand went fluttering to her throat.
Are we under attack?
No, your grace, said Ulmer of the Kingswood. "It's a watchers on the wall, is all." One blast, thought Jon Snow. Rangers returning. Then it came again.